Hello, and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and 2 hours of open forum ahead of us today. So if you have a question about the Catholic faith, now is the time to start dialing 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. If you're not familiar with open forum, it's pretty much it means open to everyone and open to pretty much every question about the Catholic faith. If you want to know about sacraments, if you want to know what we teach about salvation, what we believe about marriage, why we do the things we do, like having feast days and praying to saints and all that, you're welcome to call. And you don't have to be Catholic to call. Anybody can call. 888-318-7884. Our aim is just to answer your question. And because our guest is Jimmy Akin both hours today, when Jimmy's here, we open it up as well. If you have a question of a more generally religious or philosophical nature, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, a prolific author. The two books I have in front of me right now, A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, and the brand new one, Teaching with Authority, How to Cut Through Doctrinal Confusion and Understand What the Church Really Says. Hi, Jimmy. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm glad it's 2 hours. You knew that, right?
I'm not
shocking you.
I got a text.
Oh, you got a text saying,
literally,
we need you for 2 hours.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's freezing cold in parts of the country.
Like, this studio.
No, it's a little warm in this studio, actually. But we're looking at you, Nick. I don't know what. maybe there's something you could do about it. Folks are very, very cold around the country. So
hope they have warm studios.
Yeah, right. Or even
or
one
loft
bedrooms
apartments, or
or a house, or a car, something to keep warm in. But you do interviews all around the country. You are gracious enough to come to us after having just done an extensive interview. It's just Jimmy Akin is just in demand everywhere
on certain days, anyway. So today you and I taped some segments for the Catholic Answers TV show, and then. Did an hour on Station of the Cross, and now I'm doing 2 hours with you. So that's with coming and going, that's like 4 hours worth of stuff to interview. So kind of put a cramp in my writing time today.
So you just pack on the carbs on those days? You just say,
no.
What?
I have not eaten since last night. So I typically have one meal a day in the evening. So won't be till tonight.
Yeah. A whole bunch of calls. Look at that, Jimmy.
Hey,
they're all lit up.
Awesome.
I feel like we should just go to the phones then.
Let's do it.
Tom in New York, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Thanks for downloading the app to your phone. Tom, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Jimmy. I was wondering if you had heard of the website, the Catholic Militant, and if that was a normative group in line with church teaching.
Do you mean Church Militant?
I believe that's correct, yes.
Okay. All right. Just want to make sure. Yep. So, Jimmy?
So, my understanding is that the organization that runs it, Church Militant, is a broadly Orthodox Catholic institution. That doesn't mean all of the views you're going to hear expressed through them are going to be necessarily correct, but it does mean that they are broadly Orthodox. I know that they have received criticism, including from their local bishop. Originally, they had the word Catholic in their name, and they were told to take it out because of various things that they had said that their bishop deemed problematic. So I would say, like with anything else, exercise critical thinking.
What do you think, Tom?
Okay, great. That's excellent. I was just that's an excellent answer. I appreciate it.
Okay, thanks. You got a good rating on the first answer.
Thank you.
Today. Yeah,
awesome.
So a local bishop can do that. A local bishop can say you can't use the word Catholic.
That's correct. Yes.
They never seem to do that with any of these universities. Oops, that maybe is a personal bias of mine.
Well,
sorry about that. Devante in Odessa, Texas. You are up next with Jimmy Akin. Your question, please, Devante.
Hello, how are you guys today?
Doing okay.
Very well.
Oh, okay. I just had a question. So a while ago, I was reading Trent Horn's book, Hard Sayings, Mm-hmm. And there's a section where he's talking about the Leningrad Codex.
Okay.
And I was just looking up some stuff on it, and it was talking about how it's a Tiberian vocalization.
Okay.
And mm-hmm. I was curious about what does that mean?
Okay.
And are there other types of vocalization besides Tiberian vocalization?
Yeah. So originally, Hebrew, like other ancient alphabets, didn't have any vowels. And so the Hebrew alphabet originally consisted of just consonants, 22 consonants. And that means that you have to the way it was able to get away with that is because people already knew how to speak it. And so, like, we can abbreviate things in English, like ABR period. If you see ABR period as an English speaker, you know that means abbreviation,
mm-hmm.
for example. And so they didn't need to write out the vowels, and so they didn't invent the vowels because it was assumed as a Hebrew speaker, you would already know and be able to guess based on just the consonants what the word that you were looking at is. That's true of other ancient alphabets too. In Egyptian, for example, when you read hieroglyphics, they don't have vowels, so we have to guess what the vowels are for the most part in hieroglyphics. Eventually, though, to add greater clarity, a vowel system developed for Hebrew where they took the same consonants that they'd always used, but then they put little dots either above or below or inside the letter, little dots or marks, and these are called vowel points. And there are different ways of pointing a text, which means adding vowels to it in Hebrew. One is a system that was developed in connection with the city of Tiberias, which is a city on the shore of the Sea of Galilee
mm-hmm.
in Israel. And so, so when you have a document that has Tiberian pointing, like the Leningrad Codex. And it'll also have, in addition to the points, it'll have certain musical accents to tell the cantor to like raise or lower the pitch of his voice at specific points.
Okay.
All of that is called the vocalization of the text. And so, yeah, there are non-Tiberian vocalizations of the text, but the Leningrad Codex uses the Tiberian one.
How's that, Devante?
Okay, thank you. That was very helpful.
All right. Thank you very, very much. I have to say, I've given up writing in Egyptian hieroglyphics completely
uh-huh.
because of that guessing thing.
You're doing Demotic now?
Occasionally.
Certainly easier.
Demotic's yeah. not something bad, right?
No. Okay. Demotic is – so hieroglyphs, so it's from the Greek word hieros, meaning priest. And so the hieroglyphs are the priestly glyphs.
Oh.
They're the glyphs that the priests would use. But it's really time-consuming to make all of those, you know, fancy shapes. So more ordinary form of writing got developed called Demotic from demos, meaning
the people.
Yeah. So it's more for people rather than priests. Also, by the way, mentioning how the pointing system developed in Hebrew,
yeah.
there was an intermediate step where they used some consonants to double for a letter, to double for a vowel.
Okay.
Like, for example, the consonant aleph, which is a glottal stop in English. You hear it in the phrase a little bottle.
Oh.
We also put it on the front of every word that starts with a vowel. Like if I say apple,
yeah.
I've got a glottal stop on the front of it. I don't say apple. You know,
apple.
Yeah. I've got that stop in there.
Right.
So that's an aleph sound, but they would then use the aleph as a double for the vowel ah or a.
Oh.
And so
that gives you a clue then.
Yeah, it gives you a clue. And they would do similar things like the vowel yod, the equivalent of y, got used as the consonant y, got used as the to double for the vowel I and so
uh-huh.
forth. And so you had these. There were four letters that did double duty, and because they made it easier to read, in Latin they were called the matres lectione, or the mothers of reading.
Oh, wow. Very fancy. Well, now I got to take a break and eat an apple.
Okay.
So, it's still pro-life month though, right? Today's the 31st. Is this?
Yeah.
So it's the last day of pro-life month, so you can still get all your pro-life stuff. at Catholic Answers at shop.catholic.com for $5 a copy. Any book, DVD, whatever. If it's a pro-life one, I mean, they're all implicitly pro-life, but the explicitly pro-life ones are all on sale for $5. Go to shop.catholic.com, visit the $5 pro-life category, and get yours today.
Have you ever dialogued with someone who espouses relativism, which says there is no truth, or it might be true for you, but not for me? It's pretty frustrating. Deep down, we know these claims are false, but we often don't know why. Here's the reason. To say there is no truth is a contradiction. The assertion is tantamount to saying it's true that there is no truth. Plain absurdity. Now, the other position, there is no absolute truth, just truth relative to the individual set of beliefs, is problematic as well. The usage of the verb is implies an assertion about the objective order of things. It's the same thing as saying it's absolutely true that there is no absolute truth, which of course is a contradiction. No matter how the relativist slices the pie, he ends up with a contradiction, making relativism an unreasonable worldview. I'm Carlo Broussard with the Ready Reason for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Did you know you can book any of our great speakers to speak at your parish or special event? Contact one of our seminar coordinators through the Speakers Bureau section on Catholic.com today to find out more information.
He was a mystic and reformer who died at the age of 33.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Catherine of Siena accomplished something no one thought possible. She convinced Pope Gregory XI to return to Rome after the popes had lived in France for almost the whole of the 14th century. They've been there ever since.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live Open Forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest for both hours. And next up is Liz in Denver, Colorado, listening on 1060 AM. Liz, thanks for your call. Your question for Jimmy.
Yes, Jimmy. I've been approached with a question that I really couldn't answer. And the what I've been asked was, why is the church not excommunicating Governor Cuomo of New York due to the recent passage of the really horrible abortion bill in New York. Mm-hmm. So I just didn't know how to answer this person. I was wondering if you could help me with that.
Right. So church law does not provide excommunication for anything that a person does wrong. It only applies excommunication. It only mandates the use of excommunication for a select number of offenses. And those do include things like directly participating in an abortion. But it the way the law is framed, it doesn't include more remote things related to abortion, like passing or signing an abortion-related law. And so the automatic excommunication that gets triggered for directly participating in an abortion doesn't apply to more remote involvement, like turning on the lights at an abortion clinic, or voting for an abortion law, or building a building knowing that it's going to be used as an abortion clinic. The church could revise its law so that it includes those things, but right now it's only direct participation. Now, having said that, the penalty of excommunication can be imposed under various circumstances for things that people should not do, for various – the fancy word for them is delicts in canon law. And there are a variety of delicts that are, according to the code, to be punished with a just penalty. That's the phrase that gets used, with a just penalty. And that is meant to give the judge discretion – and the judge is typically a bishop in these cases – gives the judge discretion to scale the punishment to the magnitude of the offense. However, typically, excommunication is not your first resort as a judge. Typically, even in a case where a penalty is inflicted, you want to try to get the person corrected without having to resort to that. And so there are procedures that would indicate that in a typical trial situation that if Governor Cuomo or some other politician were put on trial and convicted, since he hadn't like previously had a canonical warning on this, that the time wouldn't be right to excommunicate him just as a matter of normal Catholic jurisprudence. You'd need to like give him the chance to repent mm-hmm. before you proceed to excommunication. But if he refused to repent, then the situation could arise where excommunication would be a just penalty that could be imposed on him by a bishop. The law, as you can understand from what I'm saying, is rather complex on this, just like laws, especially penal laws, laws that inflict punishment, are in general. And just like our civil legal system has rights that are built in for people accused of penal offenses, mm-hmm. so they can't just be ramroded into jail or railroaded into jail or whatever. The same thing is true with canon law. It has rights that are built in to protect the rights of innocent defendants that then get enjoyed by people who are also guilty. But through the process, penalty of excommunication could one day be applied to Governor Cuomo or other people who, you know, say, support abortion laws. But it doesn't happen automatically, and it doesn't happen right out of the gate. It's something that needs to proceed in stages. There's also then a question of the prudence of doing it. On the one hand, the argument would be, well, it's prudent to do this as an example to others.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you could argue it's prudent not to do this because in our present social environment, it would lead to a backlash against the church and could even lead to pro-abortion politicians being able to drum up more support for them and their evil positions. And we've even seen cases where back a number of years ago, this was in the 1980s.
Here in San Diego.
Here in San Diego, the then Bishop of San Diego excommunicated a local politician who supported abortion. I mean, she was actually in running for Congress, U.S. Congress. But he excommunicated her for supporting abortion, and it actually increased the support that she got.
Right.
So there's a prudential call that also has to be made in this regard. If you'd like to learn more about all this, or if you'd like to recommend something to your friend, I would suggest the writings of Edward Peters. He's an extraordinarily good canonist. Frankly, he's the best lay canonist in North America. And you can read his what he's written specifically about Governor Cuomo on his blog, In the Light of the Law. I believe the address is canonlaw.wordpress.com. Also, he has a very short little book that you can purchase or download from Amazon on excommunication. And if you just type in Edward Peters excommunication on Amazon, it'll come right up.
Liz, thank you very, very much for that call. It is open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, maybe one that's been nagging you, maybe the one you want help explaining to someone else, or maybe one that you think you could correct the Catholic Church on. You're all that is welcome. We're happy to take your call. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. Let's go to Kathy in Waco, Texas, listening on Red Sea Radio. Kathy, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi there. I was just wondering how the priest is supposed to pray the Eucharistic prayer. And just the reason I'm asking is because I have just moved to Texas, and we have a local priest who mumbles the Eucharistic prayer, and my 85-year-old father told him to speak up.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, no, it was his personal prayer. It was not actually a congregational prayer. And then this past week, we were in a different town, and the priest was extremely dramatic and was like shouting this huge crescendo at the end of the Eucharistic prayer. And it was almost, I thought, kind of like a circus. And I've never experienced either of those things before.
So there are different parts of the Mass that the priest is meant to say in different tones of voice. In the main, in the ordinary form of the Mass, the priest says most of the prayers out loud, including what's called the Eucharistic prayer. But there is there are and historically there were more points where the priest would pray in a low tone,
yeah,
or in a low voice,
right.
And there's still a little bit of that even in the ordinary rite of Mass. I would have to know more about the specific segment of the prayer that was either being said very privately or with great effect, because it'll vary. If it was a particular point that is meant to be said in a low tone, then the priest would be entirely right to quote unquote mumble it or say it very softly. Now, because most priests are mic'd up these days over the sound system in the church,
oh, yeah,
you often hear even the low tone prayers.
Yeah.
And so you might be used to hearing that, and it might be a little startling to encounter a priest who says part of it in a tone that is low enough it's not picked up mm-hmm. by the church sound system. So that's a possible explanation for what happened here. However, if it's the ordinary form of Mass, he shouldn't be praying the whole long Eucharistic prayer in a low tone. It is not just his personal prayer. It is meant to be heard mostly by the congregation. And so he can't just say the whole thing that way. In terms of saying it at the opposite end of the spectrum, it's a matter of prudence. How loud do you go? Sometimes priests can be elderly, and sometimes they may be unintentionally ramping up the volume so they can hear themselves mm-hmm. with impaired hearing, not realizing that it's actually very loud for a person with normal hearing. So that's a possible explanation. But in general, the priest should say most of the prayers in a tone that's loud enough to be heard without being alarmingly loud or alarmingly soft.
How's that, Kathy?
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. You are listening to Catholic Answers Live, and it's open forum today, so we're happy to take your call on any question involving the Catholic faith, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and up next is Jeff in Middletown, Ohio, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Jeff, thank you for your call. Your question for Jimmy.
Well, hi, guys. Okay, this is just a fun little question. I think I'm a recent RCI guy, and mm-hmm. we have been chatting about this. In the Lord's Prayer, mm-hmm. he descended into hell and on the third day rose again from the dead.
Mm-hmm.
Again. Why is the word again in there?
Because he first descended. So it's like if I descend and lay down on my bed and then in the morning I get up off my bed, I can say I rose again because I first descended to lay on my bed, then I ascended or rose again. In the same way, Jesus descended to the dead, but then he ascended back to the land of the living, and thus he rose again.
So it's that simple.
Yep, it's that simple.
Sometimes they are, Jeff.
I figured it was.
Jeff,
they dared me to call it in, and I did. So thank you, guys.
No problem.
Good. I hope
dare to call.
I hope you get something for meeting the dare. I don't. Maybe there's some kind of bet on the line. I don't know. 888-318-7884, the number. 888-318-7884. Let's go to, I don't know if it's pronounced Jesus or Jesus in Battle Creek.
I would assume Jesus. That's the more common these days.
It is indeed. Battle Creek, is that Michigan? Battle Creek? Watching on
Michigan.
Skype. Jesus, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, guys. Can you hear me?
Yes, what's your question? We're close to the break.
Yes, Jimmy. So my question has to do with the Council of Constance.
Mm-hmm.
And one of their documents, I think it's called Hac Sancta Synodus. So in your 20 plus years of experience, what has been the best solution that you have seen to the claim that the council, through that document, taught infallibly or definitively conciliarism?
So conciliarism is a view that councils are superior to popes, and there have been councils that did try to teach conciliarism, but an ecumenical council's decrees never attain binding force unless the pope assents to them. And guess what? The pope did not assent to that teaching. And so consequently, it doesn't have any authority in the church, much less does it have infallible authority.
Okay.
Yeah. The pope did assent to other decrees of the Council of Constance, giving them authority, but did not assent to that decree.
Jesus, thank you so much for that call. It is open forum today. The number 888-318-7884. We've got Jimmy Akin with us both hours. So get in that queue, and we've got a really good chance of getting your question through. 888-318-7884. Right back after this.
Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin is coming right back.
A generation ago, Christian parents didn't have to worry about how to explain transgenderism to their 9-year-old children or help their teenager deal with mockery at school for believing in traditional marriage. But today, as our culture decays, we have to know how to talk to our children about these issues. In Made This Way, How to Prepare Kids to Face Today's Tough Moral Issues, Layla Miller and Trent Horn give parents the crucial tools and techniques to form children with the understanding they need, appropriate to their age and maturity level, to meet the world's challenges. If we're not teaching our children how to understand tough moral issues, then the world will. Read Made This Way and learn how to give your kids a firm foundation on which to build a life of moral clarity and happiness. Order your copy of Made This Way today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or logging onto the shop at Catholic.com.
Is the church wrong on contraception? In a culture that worships the pursuit of sexual pleasure, the Catholic Church's teaching on contraception can seem archaic and unintelligible. Its critics say it's outdated, theologically unfounded, and even harmful. And even faithful Catholics can have difficulty explaining this moral teaching. Catholic Answers is out to change all of that. That's why we've just released Trent Horn's dynamic new DVD, The Case Against Contraception. Using scripture, papal and magisterial teachings, natural law, and new insights provided by social science and medicine, Trent puts forward a compelling case for Catholic teachings with his trademark charity and persuasive graciousness. Be prepared to give a defense. Order your copy of The Case Against Contraception today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
And I'm Deacon Harold. The Morning Glory team tackles football, our foundress, and food on a fun Friday.
Tomorrow morning, 7 Eastern. Now back to Catholic Answers Live. Hey, Cy.
That's the last day Gloria's going to do that. After this, she can't do it anymore. Somebody else will be pitching to us. 888-318-7884. Our number here. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and Jimmy Akin is our guest both hours today. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, and Teaching with Authority, How to Cut Through Doctrinal Confusion and Understand What the Church Really Says. That's the latest from Jimmy Akin. Jimmy?
Not the latest one I'm writing.
No, because
I started a new one this morning.
You did? Yeah. And you have, what, 50,000 words written? I started Oh, no, because you had to do radio with us.
Yeah. I started 20 Answers New Testament this morning for a 20 Answers series.
Right.
And I've done about the first four questions so far, which is about 3,500 words. But then I had to do 4 hours of interviews today. Yeah. So.
Well,
I'll get more written tomorrow.
You'll 20 answers. That means you give a question and then you give the answer.
Answer.
Is the first question.
I do that.
Who
20
put the
times.
New in New Testament?
No. I do answer that implicitly.
Oh, okay. All right. Mike in Michigan.
I do not, however, answer who put the bam in bam shabamalam. Who put the bop in the bop shabop shabop.
That's what I was coming back with you. Mike in Michigan, you're up next. Your question for Jimmy.
Hey, can I make this two-part question? Since I am driving from Battle Creek, Michigan, but I'm driving to Cleveland, Ohio, station can I find you guys in Cleveland, Ohio?
I got to look that up.
And my real question, okay, and it just happened to be on my dad's radio, and I'm driving back to Cleveland, so I'm glad I found you guys on the radio. But my main question is, as a Catholic, I struggle with people who do the whole born again and the Catholics are not born again. Mm-hmm. And I believe we gain our salvation through our baptism, and also we get it confirmed through our confirmation. But how do you, not argue, but how do you have the conversation with the person who says that unless you have that born again experience, you do not have salvation?
I would begin by pointing out a couple of things. The first thing is a piece of common ground, which is that we need to have a conscious relationship with God that impacts our lives. So we both agree with that. We it's not the case that you can just call yourself a Christian but never let that have any impact in your life and expect to be saved. Because by doing that, you'd be turning your back on God. If you really understand that that God is who He is, that He's our Savior and He's our Lord, then that means that you need to take Him very seriously. And so you need to have what is often termed a personal relationship with Him. So we can agree on that. That's true. The question is whether or not there needs to be a sudden moment of and this will be understood differently by different people who use the born again language, whether there needs to be a moment in your life where you suddenly turn to Him and have this powerful experience that's sometimes called a born again experience. Even many people in the Protestant church historically have been very devout Christians who clearly have a relationship with Jesus and who do let it affect their lives, even though they say were baptized as babies and they never had a moment of crisis where they had a conversion. They just always grew up always being a Christian and always taking God and Jesus very seriously. And by pointing to individuals like that, if the person you're speaking with has a kind of crisis conversion view, you could point out, well, no, look, even in the Protestant community, there are all of these people who are clearly living lives of grace, even though they were raised as Christians, and so they've always taken God seriously. So the crisis idea of conversion isn't necessary. Sometimes God reaches people in a crisis-type conversion, but other times it's a smooth experience where they just grow in wisdom and understanding as they're raised in the Christian community. Then there's the question of what is it to be born again? What does that mean? And obviously it means we're given new spiritual life by God, but when does it happen in the course of the Christian life? Well, there are different views on this. In the evangelical community, many people who talk about having a born-again experience believe that the point at which we're born again is the point of conversion, where we make a conscious decision for God, whether it's accompanied by a dramatic set of emotional experiences or whether it's something much quieter. It's the moment when we first put our faith in God. And so there are people who say that. But there are a lot, in fact, the vast majority of Christians don't think that. According to a theory that's advocated by Calvinists, the point at which you're born again is actually before you convert. It's the, according to them, the view, the point at which you're born again is the point that enables you to have faith. So in their view, it precedes faith. In the view of Catholics and Eastern Orthodox and other Eastern Christians and Anglicans and Lutherans and Methodists and even some Presbyterians, the point at which you're born again occurs in the sacrament of baptism. And so actually that's by far the most common view among Christians worldwide, is that the point at which we're born again is in baptism. That's why in the Gospel of John, Jesus says you must be born of water and the Spirit. And that's why if you study the writings of the early church fathers, as I have and as I document in my book, the fathers know best, they all understood baptism as the point of regeneration. And so I would say we can agree that people need to have a conscious commitment to God and to Jesus Christ, and it does need to affect their lives. But different Christians, including other Protestants, understand regeneration differently, understand what it is to be when we're born again differently. And the majority viewpoint, based on good biblical and patristic evidence, is actually that we're born again in baptism.
Mike, thank you very, very much for that. I'm ashamed to tell you. The Catholic radio station in Cleveland is The Rock AM 1260, and I'm ashamed I didn't know that right away because Bernadette, the station manager there, has been a big supporter of Catholic Answers. So I should have known that right away.
Everyone has momentary lapses.
Yeah, but I mine's been going on for 54 years, Jimmy, my momentary lapse. Stephen in Lubbock, Texas, you are up next. Stephen's joining us on Facebook Live. Thanks for finding us there, Stephen. Your question for Jimmy.
Sure. So my question is, since Adam and Eve, upon their sin, brought death into the world, if death had never been introduced into the world, would the human race have eventually gotten so big that we just kind of ran out of room on Earth?
Well, the answer is unknowable. One of the reasons for that is because the fundamental reason is because we're simply not told what would have happened if this had occurred. God did give our first parents the mandate to multiply and fill and subdue the earth. And so, you know, the earth does have finite space on it and finite resources to support a population. And so if God allowed an unfallen race or a fallen race like ours to propagate long enough – and to have a reproductive rate that's higher than the rate of death, which would be guaranteed if everybody's immortal, then eventually, after some amount of time, the planet will be full. Based on natural principles, the planet would end up full and not able to support additional people. Its resource carrying capacity would be reached. Now, we're not yet at that point today, even with 7 billion people. And in an unfallen environment, it could have more than that, perhaps multiple times more than that. But there would eventually be a point where it would run out. And at that point, a number of things could happen. God could say, okay, guess what, guys? Mission accomplished. You filled the earth and subdued it. No more babies are needed. So don't have them. And presumably at that point, people would stop having sex because there are no more babies needed. And they'd begin to live like the angels of heaven, which Jesus said is our fate anyway. According to another theory, the whole reason we were created, and this is just a theory, this is not church teaching, so please don't think you got to accept this. It's just speculation. The reason that we were created in the first place was to replace the angels that fell. And so even if we had not fallen, there's a maximum cap on the number of humans that would be reached as soon as we replace the number of angels that fell. And if we remained unfallen, we'd just get to that goal, that number of human saints quicker, at which point we'd be folded into the kingdom of heaven and, again, be like the angels of heaven. Another thing that could happen in an unfallen state, some theologians have speculated that humans had the preternatural gifts, which we today would refer to as superpowers, in their unfallen state.
And now so this is getting interesting.
They could have used their superpowers to maybe overlap each other, like Kitty Pryde can phase inside objects, or sustain themselves without food, like some superheroes, or fly to other planets like other superheroes.
Oh, yeah.
And so they could have just started colonizing the universe using their superpowers. So that's a possibility. Another possibility is that if we had not fallen, that God would simply have brought the world to an end and brought us into the kingdom once the earth filled up. Also, he could have allowed, even without superpowers, he could have allowed technology to develop, to carry us to other planets or to get more resources out of the Earth. So there are a bunch of possibilities, but the Earth does have finite resources, and one way or another that fact would and will have to be dealt with if God allows history to go on long enough for us to hit Earth's carrying capacity.
Stephen, what do you think?
That's awesome. So I'm not sure if this is a question I need to ask later, but that death, does it necessarily mean physical death, or could it mean spiritual death? Like, is there an absolute saying, oh yeah, that death, which is referenced in Genesis, means physical human death? Do we know a definite answer on that?
So the virtual universal understanding of commentators and theologians is that that when God tells Adam and Eve, in the day you eat of the fruit, you will die, he is including physical death in that. Now, that then raises the question of, well, why didn't they die within 24 hours? And that is a little more speculative. Some people have said, oh, well, they did die spiritually within 24 hours and then later would die physically. I think, though, that another explanation is more plausible. When the word day gets used, it doesn't mean always a literal 24-hour period. This is true both in English and in Hebrew. In English, the English word for day is, of course, day.
Yeah.
And we might talk about back in Ronald Reagan's day, meaning a long period of time in which Ronald Reagan lived or was president or something like that.
Right.
In Hebrew, the same thing happens with the word yom, which is the Hebrew word for day.
Uh-huh.
So if you look at the beginning, if you look at Genesis 1, we have the series of seven yomim in which God creates the heavens and the earth.
Right.
But then in the beginning of Hebrews 2, it says this is the record of when the heavens and the earth were created in the day, yom, singular, that God created them. And so here in Genesis 2, we have yom being used for this other long period of time that we know is actually presented as being multiple days. And so consequently, when I look at the text in Genesis that says, in the day you eat of it, you will die, I think the sense is not in the 24-hour period you eat of it, you will die. I think it's in the period more generally that you eat of it, you will die. So it's in a post-eating period you're going to die. If you don't eat it, you won't die.
Stephen, thank you very, very much for those questions. You've made me long for my superpowers. I'd like to know what they were, and I'd like them back.
And you'll get them back if you're faithful to God.
Oh, all right. Another motivator.
Yeah.
You have an article in
The Christian Faith Offers Superpowers.
I'm just another reason to love God and be grateful. How to make your apologetic arguments bulletproof. That's the name of your article.
Bulletproof apologetics. How to make your best case and avoid shooting yourself in the foot.
And that is in the next edition of Catholic Answers Magazine. And you can get Catholic Answers Magazine right now for up to $10 off, and it includes a free digital subscription when you subscribe. The offer is good only till midnight tonight. Everything, all these offers we've got, they end at the end of the month. So midnight tonight is the end of all of them, and sign up now at CatholicAnswersMagazine.com. You won't be sorry you did, and you might not shoot yourself in the foot.
Call and ask Jimmy your question today on Catholic Answers Live. Bringing you the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
EWTN, communicating the faith.
Just turned 31. Feel that I'm being called to the priesthood. And I've been attending daily mass and just finding that falling more in love with Jesus every day and finding more opportunities to, you know, make sacrifices for him, myself, and just allow him to enter me more. You know, how do we fully surrender to God and to his will so that we can more clearly hear his calling?
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Do you want to end abortion, halt the attack on traditional marriage, and ensure religious freedom for ourselves and for our grandchildren? To do this, we must convert the culture. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a grassroots initiative that recognizes this need and takes it to the streets. If you're interested in peacefully sharing the gospel in your area, visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Open Forum, Jimmy Akin, our guest, both hours. And if you live in Colorado, next hour, I'm going to put you at the top of the line. We're going to take your call first. And I'll tell you why. We usually celebrate when there's a new Catholic radio station in a state by saying if you're from that state, you go to the top. It's not a new Catholic radio station, but it's pretty much that. In Denver and Boulder, Colorado Springs, and Pueblo, the station KCRN 1120 AM is about to broadcast 50,000 watts at 50,000 watts. So we want to congratulate Jim O'Loughlin and the great team there at Catholic Radio Network. Now serving even more of Colorado with the truth, KCRN 1120 AM. 50,000 watts. Holy smokes.
So what happens after they broadcast 50,000 watts? Because they can burn through that in like a second.
I think they're gonna they've got a 50,000 watts for every second.
Oh, really?
Maybe not of the whole day.
So they're going to broadcast a lot more than 50,000 watts, just 50,000 watts at once.
At any given time,
okay.
It'll be 50,000 watts maximum.
Nice. Yeah.
And I don't know if that's at night, though, because a lot of times if you broadcast 50,000 watts at night on an AM station, that'll shoot practically around the world.
Uh-huh.
So maybe they have one of those licenses. I don't know, but – so if you're from Colorado, next hour, you go to the top of the line, 888-318-7884, the number. Tim in Buffalo, New York, you are up next. It's freezing there, isn't it, Tim? Are you freezing in Buffalo?
Oh, yeah. It's cold here, for sure.
Well, we're happy to have your call. Your question for Jimmy.
So I'm a senior at a Catholic high school here in Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
So this year, we've been learning about defenses of the faith. So my question is regarding Pascal's wager.
Okay.
Why do some people believe the premise is a failsafe used by Catholics while Catholics see it as a defense of the faith?
Okay. So you ask why do some people view it as a failsafe used by Catholics?
Right.
Do I understand that correctly? Okay. Well, so first we should start by explaining what Pascal's wager is for people who may not be familiar with it. It's an argument that was proposed by the French philosopher and mathematician Blaise Pascal back during the 1600s. And he was writing at the time a book – he was writing notes for a book that he meant to be a general apology or defense of the Christian faith. Unfortunately, he died before he completed that work, and so all we have of it are his notes. They're gathered together in a book called Pensées, or Thoughts. These were the thoughts he was collecting for his book. And in one of them, in one of the notes, it's a rather extensive note, and it's kind of crazily written. He was obviously revising it as he was thinking of it, and the writing goes off in unusual directions. But he proposes a couple of arguments that are related to each other that have come to be known as the wager. And one of the things that they did for fun back before they had internet was gamble. And so in Pascal's day, if you were a young rich man and you had money, gambling was the big thing. It was the big form of entertainment. And in fact, people like Pascal and other people like Jacob Bernoulli either were hired or on their own developed the laws of betting and so forth. They figured out the laws of probability as a result of wanting to win at gambling.
Isn't that great?
And so that's how we developed that area of mathematics. Well, Pascal is trying to reach people in his Apology for the Christian Faith who are his contemporaries. And so so he imagined people who were like him. They were Frenchmen of the 1600s, and they would say, you know, I just don't know whether I should believe or not.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I should be a skeptic like those new philosophes,
yeah.
You know, who like Voltaire, who don't believe in God or don't believe in the Christian God. Or maybe I should believe, in which case I should go to Mass and be Catholic and stuff like that. How do I decide if I can't tell based on the evidence? Now, most of what Pascal was doing in his apology was presenting evidence. That's what he planned to do. But he also wanted to cover the case of people who thought, oh man, I just can't decide based on the evidence. Well, he then said, okay, well, if we can't show you a reason to be Christian, by which he meant Catholic in particular, if we can't show you a reason to be Christian based on the evidence, if you don't find the evidence convincing, does that mean that there there aren't other reasons you should be a Christian, like maybe practical reasons. And so he proposed the wager, in which he said, okay, look, if Christianity is either true or false, these are the only two options we're considering, because these are the ones that were live options for the people he was trying to reach.
Right.
Either be, you know, a skeptic or a Christian, not be a skeptic or a Hindu or something like that. So within these two options, if you feel torn between the evidence, consider your best interests. If Christianity ends up being true and you've opted for Christianity, you've bet with your life that Christianity is true, then you're going to go to heaven and you're going to get an infinite reward, because heaven is infinite and you're going to have all eternity to be with God. On the other hand, if skepticism is true and Christianity is not true, then you're just worm food and you really haven't lost anything by betting on Christianity. So it's in your interests, if you can't decide based on the evidence, to opt for Christianity anyway, because that maximizes your interests, just like placing certain kind of bets in gambling will maximize your interests regardless of what the specific outcome is. So rather than giving an evidential reason to be Christian, he gives a practical reason to be Christian. And he proposed a couple different variants of this argument that scholars have studied. I talk about them in an article I wrote some years ago called You Bet Your Life, because that's literally what you're doing in Pascal's Wager. So check out You Bet Your Life, Jimmy Akin. In terms of why people view it differently, that's just natural. In fact, people have different estimations of the utility of different arguments, of whether they work or not or are useful or not. Personally, I think that within the limits it's designed for, I think Pascal's wager works. I think it can also be extended to cover other situations, like should you bet that you have only one life that counts, like Christianity says, or should you bet that you get multiple chances, like Hinduism says? I think your interests are going to be assuming you need to make this life count, so be a Christian rather than a Hindu. So I think it can be extended into other situations. I think a lot of people misunderstand the wager and think that it's presenting an evidential argument for Christianity. But that's not what it's doing. It's not trying to prove Christianity is true. It's trying to prove, regardless of whether it's true, you should go ahead and be a Christian because that will maximize your interests. And I think it does so successfully within the limits that it's designed to address.
What do you think, Tim?
Yeah, I agree. I agree for the most part. I thought it was a pretty interesting defense of the faith when I first heard about it. That's why I was intrigued and wanted to kind of get your guys' opinions on it.
Very good.
Yeah. Personally, I'm a fan of Pascal's wager. I think it has to be understood correctly, but I think it's quite useful. Also, it's important to characterize it correctly. Sometimes people will mischaracterize it and say, if you bet that Christianity is false and you're wrong, you'll go to hell. But that's not actually what Pascal said. That is a possible factor to include in the game theory calculus here, but it's not actually what Pascal said. He didn't mention hell.
I think that's how I first heard it. Actually, is that if you're wrong, you'll go to hell. But that's not, he
phrased it in terms of what you stand to gain versus what you stand to lose, and you stand to gain an infinite amount and stand to lose at most a finite amount. Although he argued even then you wouldn't really lose anything because the cost of denying yourself due to Christian morality, like I'm not going to go sleep around, actually is going to make you a better, more loving person. You'll be happier even in this life.
Do you know anybody, is there any record of anyone who writes about, I took Pascal's wager and
died and here's what happened?
No. I mean, then I took the wager and now I'm a believing Christian, because that was what he wanted, was for you.
Yeah. Lots of people have done that, either to become Christian or to shore up their faith in moments of doubt.
Yeah. Yeah, because all right. Thanks very much for that call, Tim, from Buffalo, New York.
Now, what are you going to do next hour?
What do you mean?
Well, we have a whole other hour of radio coming up.
I think we should just have another open forum.
Okay.
I vote that. Let's see if we can get permission to do that.
Okay.
Another hour of open forum. Anybody from Colorado goes to the top of the line because of the brand new 50,000 watts there. Jimmy Akin will be our guest for the second hour. So if you're on the line, stay on the line. If you haven't called yet, 888-318-7884.